Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today marks the 65th anniversary of the worst at-sea disaster in U.S. naval history. It's the day the Japanese torpedoed and sank the USS Indianapolis, a story so famous it's a scene stealer in Steven Spielberg's 1975 movie Jaws.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into her side, Chief. She was coming back from the island of Tinian to Lady and just delivered the bomb. The Hiroshima bomb. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger. 13-footer, you know? You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. What we didn't know was our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent.
300 sailors went down with the ship. Another 900 were plunged into the shark-infested Philippine Sea without lifeboats, food, or water. And what happened as the sailors waited for rescue is even more harrowing than Spielberg could have imagined. Here's the true story, as remembered by actual USS Indianapolis survivors Cletus Lebo, L.D. Cox, and Don McCall.
When the torpedoes hit, somehow I just instinctively knew it was a torpedo. I never had been on a ship been torpedoed before.
And whoom, started to get up, and as I looked up, there was water and debris and fire just coming up above the bridge.
And I jumped, I think, about 60 or 70 feet into the water. But I knew I had to swim away from the ship because of the suction of the ship. It'll pull you down if you don't get away from it. And I swam as far as I could and stopped and turned around and watched it go down.
You know, the ship sank in 12 minutes.
The next morning, a floater net bundle came by. There probably was 50 or 60 guys were able to get up on it. And that's where I spent the next 4 days and 5 nights.
Sharks started the first day and they worked on us. And in fact, one of my buddies within 3 feet of me was taken under with a shark.
So I just said a little short prayer. Lord, help me. And when I did, a feeling of calm, peace just overtook me. And I knew everything was going to be okay. I was either going home to Abernethy or I was going home to heaven. And it didn't make any difference which. But everything was all right.
For the men who did not survive, that feeling of calm and final peace came through the ministering of the ship's chaplain, Father Thomas Conway, who waded in the water with them. Conway was ordained in Springfield, Massachusetts, and served St. Michael's Cathedral there. His role in the Indianapolis tragedy was once lost to history, but it's been rediscovered by Bill Milholm, former Massachusetts reference archivist, who joins us now. Bill Milholm, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, tell me, what is it that got you interested in the story of Father Conway?
Two things. In 2001, the book In Harm's Way was published. And in that book, a number of book reviewers had mentioned that they wished they had known more about the activities of the chaplain. And at that time, I was managing grant programs throughout the Commonwealth for the Massachusetts Archives, and I was involved in setting up veterans' oral history projects. I was also completing 10 years of recording the oral histories of missionary priests to South America. So the two came together, and I decided to find out this man's life, and that journey was an incredible journey, and now the story exists, and I think it's a model for chaplains who are serving today. And the comfort that Father Conway brought certainly we should be thinking about our chaplains who are serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so there's a lot to be commemorated.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about what Father Conway did in particular, because, of course, the USS Indianapolis was on a top-secret mission. Even the sailors aboard didn't know what they were carrying. They were carrying the two bombs that would fall on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan to end the war, the Second World War with Japan, at least. But then, just after midnight, following, I believe, the ship actually successfully completing its mission and delivering its cargo, the Japanese actually torpedoed the Indianapolis in the Philippine Sea. So we heard a little bit about the harrowing experiences of the men who went in the water who actually survived the ship's sinking. But Father Conway was one of them. He was on board. So tell us a little bit about what you learned of his actions when he was in the water with these other 900 men.
Well, I think I'd like to begin that when he was a priest serving later in Buffalo, New York, many parishioners remembered him as a sailor sailing Lake Erie in his sailboat. And several altar boys remember going out with him. And then a chaplain from Buffalo was killed in 1942, and that's Father Conway decided to fill that role. So when he was in the Navy, he was assigned to the USS Indianapolis, I believe, in August of 1944. And there was just one chaplain to both Catholics and Protestants. He would do both services. He would hold confessions and have conferences in the library and brought consolation from many of the men, not only the ones you heard today, but some of the ones that I have quoted in some of my research.
Mm. And so I'm trying to imagine, it's almost impossible to imagine, but I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to be in the water for 4 days, 5 nights, being circled by sharks, seeing your fellow sailors passing away, some of them, you know, being attacked by sharks, and not even knowing if you're going to be rescued. I mean, that was something that sailors, I believe, were told that they should be rescued within 2 days, but they were in the water for four. So how is it what are some of the things that survivors told you about the way that Father Conway actually gave them reassurance or gave them hope or care?
Well, I was fortunate to have an opportunity to communicate with two of the men that were in the group. When the ship sank and the 900 men went in, they broke up into groups, and there was a group of about 100 sailors, of which Father Conway was in that group. And over the period of 3-4 days, they actually floated 100 miles from where the ship was sank. And during that time, these men remember specifically that Father Conway basically swam to every man, bringing them back into the circle, telling them that they would be rescued, to have faith that they'll make it through this. He was hearing confessions for the men who passed away. He did last rites. And when they went in the water, they were just wearing these life preservers that really only should have lasted 48 hours. So as these men were going 3 nights, they were actually beginning to sink in the water. And as men would die, they would have to take off their life jackets and give it to other men to stay afloat. Mm. And Father Conway, when he was when they did a memorial for him at the Naval Park in Buffalo, his bust is two things he's doing. One, he's holding the dog tags, and the other one, he was holding life preservers. And that's what he did. And he's remembered going around, hearing prayers, saying prayers, trying to keep these men sane, because it wasn't so much the shocks as it was dehydration and delusion.
Exactly. And all the while, I imagine that he himself is trying to maintain his own sanity amongst the physical and emotional and spiritual pressures. I was really moved by some of the research and stories that you were able to find about Father Conway from survivors. Here's one excerpt, I believe. This is from the late Frank Santazzo of Rhode Island. He said that, quote, "I was in a group with Father Conway, and I saw him go from one small group to another, getting the shipmates to join in prayer and asking them not to give up hope of being rescued. He kept working until he was exhausted, but he gave us hope and the will to endure." Was he, Bill Milhome, was Father Conway the only ship's chaplain on board? There was just one?
There was just one chaplain, and he was the chaplain for both the Catholic and the Protestant services.
Okay. And so do you have any sense from the survivors that you spoke with as to how over the course of the 4 days and five nights, as Father Conway himself was struggling, what happened to him?
Well, you know, before I say that, I'd like to just back up. Before they went on their mission to deliver the trigger to the new, the atomic bomb and the radioactive core, previously they had been attacked by kamikazes, and nine sailors were killed in that attack. And when he was on leave, when the ship was being prepared before they went out with those things, he actually went and visited the nine families of all of the nine men that were killed. That's how close the chaplains were to death and to the men that they were serving. When he was in the water, the dehydration, the delusion, many of them remember him beginning to, near the end of his life, thrashing around and incoherently praying in Latin. And it was breaking the hearts and almost the spirit of many of the men who he was sustaining for so long.
So just to be clear, he did not survive.
No, he did not survive. He lasted on 3 nights and almost 4 days. They were in the water 84 hours, I believe, and he probably lasted 70.
Hmm. Well, if I understand correctly, Father Conway was, when he passed away, was the last chaplain to die in World War II combat. And you had mentioned what he was like in his last hours. And there's some words from another survivor, Captain Lewis Haynes. He wrote, quote, "The night is particularly difficult, and the chaplain's delirium mounts. His struggles are almost too much for me. I grab the chaplain and thrust my arm through the chaplain's life jacket so that I may hold him securely through his wild thrashing. He cries a strange gibberish, some of the words in Latin, but in a little while he sinks into a coma." And then Father Conway, not long thereafter, passed away. Bill Milhomme, you said something very interesting at the beginning of our conversation here, in that in studying the life and the service of Father Thomas Conway, it got you thinking about chaplains, military chaplains serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, the research I try to do is to discover stories of men and women who have lived selfless lives and weren't trying to be heroes, but lived heroic lives. And in my research, I've interviewed over 100 priests who are missionaries, and I've had the honor to interview many veterans. And a chaplain's role is just so important to sustain the spirit of men and women in combat, to be someone who can be counted on, because a lot of these men in World War II were 17, 18, 19 years old.
As soldiers are today.
Exactly. They were very, very young, and Tom himself was 37 years old, which is quite young as far as I'm concerned now. But it's unbelievable the consolation and the presence that chaplains are to military people, not only serving overseas, but even here in the United States.
And one can imagine when they're thrust into such stressful and surprising and unexpected circumstances that the spiritual support is that much more important in those hours.
Exactly. And as I'm thinking, when Tom Conway was a chaplain in World War II, really was Protestants and Catholics, and now the military has the challenge of chaplains for many faiths.
Well, Bill Milhomme, former Massachusetts Reference Archivist and Director of Volunteer Services at the Massachusetts Department of Correctional Services, but the man who brought us the story of Father Thomas Conway, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for helping me to preserve his story.
It often takes a tragedy to reveal the fundamental fragility of a system, and for our oceans, the Gulf oil spill has done just that. But even before oil began gushing into Gulf waters, Massachusetts sound artist Halsey Burgund felt inspired to explore our emotional connection to the sea.
I go to the ocean
and
to
feel really cool if you think
as
about,
if
like,
I can find something deeper.
How many
His new project is called Ocean Voices, and it will be performed tonight at the Museum of Science.
Vast. I can imagine, like, if you're on a boat in the ocean.
WBUR arts reporter Andrea Shea has our story.
Jacques Cousteau would have turned 100 this year. Like a lot of us, sound artist Halsey Burgund first learned about life under the waves by watching the French explorers' documentaries and TV shows in the 60s and 70s.
You know, Jacques Cousteau would always say people protect what they love.
All of you who love the sea, help us protect her.
He's somebody who brought the ocean to the masses.
Cousteau used film to do that. Burgund is using music, sort of.
Every time I go into the ocean, every time I...
Oh.
At a rehearsal for his performance, Burgund showed me his home studio in Bedford. It's filled with instruments, microphones, and computers, like an audio laboratory.
I am not a scientist at this point. I'm not a politician. I'm not going to, you know, there's lots of things that I'm not. But what I am is a musician and a sound artist, and I think I can affect some small change in the ways that I know how. And Ocean Voices has really been a way for me to do that.
Very hard.
I think the world would be kind of like dry and like empty.
Ocean Voices is an experiment in ocean advocacy. It combines music with human voices, hundreds of them, reflecting on the sea. Burgund plays the voices by manipulating a unique electronic device called a mallet cat. It looks like a high-tech xylophone.
So if I have this button pressed down, it's
no water control.
I can hear these kids.
Well, I think we'd probably
talking
fact,
about the ocean.
Without the ocean, our Earth wouldn't even be here.
And then if I press a different button, this same instrument can become a marimba, or it can become a piano. But the voices are the primary thing that I'm playing when we're performing, and I think of the voices as another instrument.
I like the ocean when it's raining. And it's warm because you can't tell the difference between the rain and the ocean.
But how did the sound artist get these voices? With the help of marine biologist Wallace J. Nichols and the internet. Together, the artist and the scientist created an interactive website and an iPhone app so anyone, even you, can record your own voices and upload them to the project. Here's scientist Nichols.
We just started collecting voices from people all over the world in response to a set of questions about how they feel about the ocean, how they interact with the ocean, what they know about the ocean.
With every drop of water you drink, every breath you take, you're connected to the sea, no matter where on Earth you live.
That woman recorded her voice at sea in the North Pacific. The question, describe a world without oceans, prompted this from a landlocked region of India.
I don't want to imagine a world without oceans. Our world without oceans can simply not exist.
Burgund and Nichols have collected more than 1,000 voices so far, all ages and ethnicities. Three of Jacques Cousteau's now grown grandchildren gave their blessing to the project and even pitched in their own voices, including filmmaker Céline Cousteau.
There is always something going on underneath the waves. There is always something going on. It is a sensation of underneath the waves.
Scientist Wallace J. Nichols, a lifelong ocean advocate and sea turtle expert, knows how deeply people feel about the ocean. But he says mixing our thoughts with music, performed by Halsey Burgund and a live band, hits us in a universal but intimate way.
People describe it afterwards and they say, wow, I felt like I was just tapped into a lot of different people's private thoughts about the ocean all at the same time.
I see a world without oceans as a place without having depth. Land extends on forever, but the ocean expresses a deep unknowing.
That's what Jacques Cousteau was all about. He was about getting under your skin, into your brain, and showing you something that literally would blow your mind.
If I want to know what it feels like to be in the ocean, I just have to close my ears shut, and then it feels like I'm floating in the ocean, and there's a low kind of throbbing noise, and it also feels like being in the womb
Ocean Voices premiered at the California Academy of Science earlier this year to celebrate Jacques Cousteau's 100th birthday. The performance is going on tour, and the web project is ongoing. Right now, though, the artist and the scientist who created Ocean Voices want people to react to the oil spill in the Gulf. They recently added a new question to their website. How do oceanic spills make you feel? For WBUR, I'm Andrea Shea. I
was born and raised in Madrid, right in the center of the Iberian Peninsula, surrounded by ocean, yet deprived of it. I grew up in a world...
Halsey Burgund also has a sound installation at the De Cordova Museum in Lincoln, Massachusetts as well. Radio Boston's Adam Ragusea took a tour of that, and you can hear it at wbur.org/Boston. Leave us a comment while you're there on this story or any other story you hear on Radio Boston, or give us a call on our listener line at 617-353-1137. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. Our program is produced by Adam Ragusea, Jessica Alpert, Dan Mazzi, and Ted Seifer. Our interns are Megan Kane, Talia Ralph, Jake Mahoney, and Hugh Roberts. Tim Skog is our technical director. The senior producer of Radio Boston is Mark Navin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Do have a wonderful weekend and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.